James Gillen with BBS Radio. We've got a great show tonight. I have a few announcements to make real quick. Leslie Keene, who was going to be on the last show, couldn't make it due to Bud Hopkins having some kind of an illness. They had to take her to the hospital, so she had her hands full that night. So send some blessings off to Bud and Leslie and hope they get through whatever challenges they have. And we'll get her back on the show here real soon. There's so many things going on. I'm going to skip some of the other announcements because we've got a great show tonight. If anybody has been watching the news or been on the internet, I'm sure you've all heard about this, but it's been aired all over the news, CNN, Fox News. I don't know how many other stations have aired this. But our guest tonight, Robert Salas, has been kind of blowing the lid off the UFO cover-up. And he was a captain at a U.S. Air Base, Malmstrom, hope I said that right. And he's the author of Failed Giant. And there's been a lot of activity over five different bases in five different states where UFOs have actually interacted with nuclear missiles and shut them down in some cases and activated them in others and just kind of played with our technology. So anyway, to cover this, we're going to bring Robert on the show. Robert, are you with us?
I'm with you, James. Thank you for inviting me.
Hey, thank you so much for coming on the show, and especially I have to commend you on the courage and the integrity you have in bringing this information out. I know what it's like to be on the edge of this and bringing this kind of information out, and I'm sure you're having all kinds of daggers and other things thrown at you, and character assassinations, a few other things that come with this process.
Yes, right. There's always some skeptics out there. I know there's been one individual in particular. I won't mention his name because I don't want to give him any more oxygen
yeah.
than he's already had. But if people want to check on what I have for evidence, in my case, I think I've got a very strong case. They can go to the UFO Chronicles. That's theufochronicles.com. And they go down the right side there, go down to some of the stories I've written. They'll see my photograph, and just click on the first one. I think it says My Evidence, and that'll give everybody a kind of a rundown of what kind of evidence I have to support my case. I can briefly go over that now if you like.
Yeah, I would love to. First of all, I wanted to, with your record and you're in charge of nuclear missiles, and, they don't put crackpots in charge of nuclear missiles.
So,
you guys have your finger on the trigger, basically. So, it doesn't make any sense for them to even try to, attack your character or anything else, because that would be a real bad mark on their side as far as who they're putting in control of things. But obviously they are, but we can go further than that. But to me, it's like that's a no-brainer. They should just throw that one out. And just the bottom line is that you wouldn't be in the position you were in if you weren't of a very noble character and high integrity, and and didn't fantasize around things.
Well, thanks for those comments, James. I try to be straight and straightforward with people. But again, there'll always be people that won't trust you. I guess that's kind of the society we live in today. It's don't trust whatever anybody tells you until you check it all out. But that's fine. I've been speaking about this for 15 years. This is the third time actually I've been to the National Press Club and talked to the press. But this certainly was the most rewarding time. Let's put it that way. We had a full house at the press club, and by luck or other reason, we had CNN decide to do a live streaming taping of the show, and so millions of people saw it around the world, I'm sure. And as a result of that, all the other stations, mainstream stations, wanted to jump on the bandwagon. So, yeah, we got Fox in there, and then we got MSNBC, you name it, CBS, ABC. I've been on a show for the Canadian Broadcasting Company, and Mr. Hastings also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's been great, fantastic.
The information that I've been seeing going out on the net and just on the news and everything else is just phenomenal. And for some reason, this time it has just taken off like a wildfire. And you know, and with the list of people and the credentials there, I don't even see how they could even consider there even being a cover up anymore. it's like the cat's out of the bag for any reasonable mind.
Yeah. Well. Again, I won't mention his name, but with somebody in Canada, actually, I think, contacted the Air Force at NORAD headquarters and then also Air Force headquarters and tried to get a comment from them. And they're sticking to their current policy, which was first stated back in 1969 after the Condon Committee.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know about that, and some of your guests, Condon Committee, investigated UFOs. But after that, that whitewash, the Air Force said, "Well, these things don't mean much to us. They're not affecting national security, so we're not even going to look at them anymore." But here we've got seven good men and true. We all signed affidavits with. You know, in front of a notary public, in telling our stories, we put those down on paper and signed affidavits. By the way, if your listeners want to see those affidavits, they can go to my website because I've got them up there now, and that is spiralgalaxy.org, spiralgalaxy.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to talk about, first of all, maybe you can talk about your experience there for those who haven't heard. And exactly what happened there, and then we can go into some of the evidence around that you compiled.
Sure. Yeah, 1967, I was a young first lieutenant at stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base. I was a missile launch officer. And basically my duties were to crew up with another man. It would be the missile crew commander. That was Fred Maiwald in this case. Fred's still alive and well. We were sent out to Oscar Flight. Oscar Flight is, just to explain to your listeners, I was a member of the 498th Squadron, and we had five different flights of 10 missiles in our squadron. Each flight has 10 missiles, like I said. These are called launch control facilities where we would go to. Oscar Flight was about 100 miles east of the city of Great Falls, Montana. And so we were out there on the evening of March 24th, 1967. I get a call from my guards upstairs. We are underground, by the way, in a concrete mm-hmm. capsule. It's what we would call it's protected from nuclear blasts. Anyway, it's underground, hardened is the word I was thinking of, hardened
mm-hmm.
cap. And we've got four to five guards upstairs, depends. And so the first call I get from the guard, he's saying they're observing lights in the sky. They're making strange maneuvers. Going very fast, stopping on a dime, reversing direction, going 90-degree turns and that sort of thing, and they're silent, not making
mm-hmm.
any noise. He says they're not aircraft. And he was concerned about this, but I didn't quite, you know, I didn't get it, I guess, at first. I didn't think much of it. I had really not thought much about UFOs at that time. So anyway, I kind of hung up the phone, and then he calls back in about 5 minutes. And this time, he's very frightened. You can tell by his voice; he's scared to death. He's got all the men out there with their guns, their weapons drawn, and they're looking at this object. He said they're looking at a glowing red pulsating object. It's oval shaped, about 30 feet in diameter. And it's just sitting above the front gate. It's just hovering there silently. And it's got everybody freaked out. He wanted me to tell him what to do next. And I think I told him to make sure the perimeter fence is protected and nothing gets in. So I hung up the phone. First thing I thought, we might be under some kind of a terrorist attack. I go to wake up my commander, who's taking a nap. And just as I'm starting to tell him about the phone calls, the missiles start going in a no-go condition. In other words, they became disabled. So we got 10 red lights across the board while this object was still up there. We go through a checklist procedure, of course, and my commander calls the command post back in Malton. Pardon me.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have security light violations. So I call back upstairs at that point and ask the guard if that object is still there, and he said, no, it's gone off. It flew off at high speed. And then I directed that two of the security teams, we call them SAT teams, go out to these two launch facilities and check on these so-called incursions or incursions around the perimeter fence of launch facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the indicators we had. So the teams go out there, and sure enough, they report seeing more UFOs out there. So, and then the next thing I recall vividly was my commander turning to me and saying the same thing happened at another flight. And that's one of the more vivid memories I have. So that's basically it. We were told to report back to our squadron commander when we were relieved the next morning. I walk into the squadron commander's office. He's white as a sheet. He's an old World War II pilot. He flew B-17s in Europe. He's seen in just about everything. But he was white as a sheet. He didn't know what the hell happened. And I asked him, was this an Air Force exercise? And he said, no, absolutely not. And also in the room there was a man from Air Force Office of Special Investigations. That's the FBI of the Air Force, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he really wasn't all that interested in our story. He just wanted us to sign a document saying we would never talk about it again. And that it was now classified secret. We were never to talk to anybody about it, including other airmen, our spouses, nobody. And so I didn't. Not until 1994. You want me to go on?
Yeah, so in 94, was there a reason why you decided to come out and talk about it? Was there some kind of a lifting of this secrecy or a Freedom of Information Act or something that opened this up?
Well, in 1994, I was a student at the University of Washington studying education, master's degree in education. I had been out of the service since 1971. I resigned, and I worked for FAA for 23 years. But in '94, I had decided to retire from FAA and start a new career. And so I was in the bookstore at the University of Washington. I happened to go through and pick up a book called Above Top Secret by Timothy Good.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to turn to page 301. This is the truth. I was just flipping through it. And I stopped on page 301 for some reason. And on that page, in one paragraph there, just a short paragraph, it talks about UFOs being sighted over a missile base, and 10 missiles went down while the UFO was there. I got all excited about that. I said, hey, that's me. That's me. I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and of course, you mentioned Malmstrom, Malmstrom Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, I went to the nearest MUFON chapter and got a hold of James Klotz, first time I met him. And he's a co-author of my book, by the way. It's called Faded
mm-hmm.
Giant, Faded Giant. At any rate, I asked Klotz to submit a Freedom of Information Act request to the Air Force about this strange event, which I read in this book, about 10 missiles going down under unusual circumstances. I told Klotz not to say a thing about UFOs, so... because that would we wouldn't get a good response, I'm sure. So he did. The Air Force wrote back and said, you know, this is still classified, but since you've asked and since it's been so long, we're going to declassify the incident and send you some documents. So they started sending us documents surrounding, and this is called the Echo Flight Incident. So the documents, specific, very specific about the date of the incident and the fact that they went down for no known reason and that it was of grave concern to the Strategic Air Command headquarters.
I think that's interesting that, you know, here they're saying it's of grave concern, but then in the, you know, Connor report and the other ones, they said that they're of no concern.
Right, right.
You know, it would concern me if a UFO, you know, took over my whole launch facility and had the ability to either fire or change the directions or do whatever they want. You know, I'd be a little concerned.
Right, exactly. This was clearly a national security incident. And that telegram itself, you know, just by itself, is indicative of that. The Air Force had no clue as to why these missiles went down the way they did. These are very reliable systems. They're all independent of each other. They're not
mm-hmm.
connected in series like a string of Christmas tree lights or anything like that. But at any rate, as a result of these documents that I started getting, I decided to go public, you know, and tell
mm-hmm.
my story. And so I did. I went on a sighting show, and then I went on the Art Bell show, and so I started talking. At the time I started talking about this, I thought I was the guy at Echo Flight. Well, it turns out that I wasn't one of the crew members of Echo Flight. I was at another flight. I was at Oscar Flight.
Mm.
So I was finally able to contact the two crew members of Echo Flight. That's Eric Carlson and Walt Fiegel. Both are still alive, as far as I know. And then I was able to contact my commander in the capsule, Fred Maiwald. So this is part of the critical evidence that I've got. I've got Fiegel on audio tape. He's given me permission to use it, and I have published that audio tape. Again, it's on that website I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a story that Robert Hastings wrote in support of this case. And then I've got Fred Maiwald on audio tape, you know, backing the story up I just told you. Pretty much. He thinks that there were less than 10 missiles that went down, but I'm sticking to my story because I've got another supportive witness, and that is Robert Jameson, who was one of the speakers at the press club. And Jameson recalls vividly on March 24th going out to Oscar Flight and working on our missiles, and all 10 of them had gone down. So he's on record as stating that. Let's see, where would you like to go from there?
I know if they find one little glitch in your story, that they'll throw everything else and just focus on that one glitch. So
yeah.
Yeah, so it's amazing that you have these people coming forward and backing you up, you know, 100%, and it's always necessary in this field.
Well, I can't say 100%. Some of these guys are just reluctant to, come mm-hmm. forward, like the three gentlemen I mentioned, Maywald and Fiegel and Carlson, have really wanted to stay in the background. They didn't want to be out there about this. By the way, with Eric Carlson, I have two letters from him under his signature, and one letter he supports what Walt Fiegel told me during our telephone conversation on tape.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he and Fiegel collaborated after that phone call, and he said that he couldn't remember anything else other than what Fiegel had said.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, that's the essential part of my test, evidence. I've also got letters from Bob Kaminsky, who was head of the Boeing team that investigated the Echo Flight shutdowns.
Mm-hmm.
And in this letter to me, under his signature, again, he says this was a UFO incident, as told mm-hmm. to him, that it was a UFO incident.
Have you heard anything from the guards, or have any of them come forward? This they've got to have seen this. It's all over the news. So,
yes, I'm really hopeful that they'll come forward. I haven't heard from any of them. I'll tell you, these guys were all weapons trained. This was during the Vietnam War, and I'm afraid some of them got sent to Vietnam and may not have come back.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not heard from any of the guards in my case.
Well, I hope they didn't make sure they didn't come back. You know how that goes sometimes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. It's amazing how with all this evidence and the witnesses, the impeccable credibility of the witnesses, and I know with all of the other bases that the information is coming out with Robert Hastings' work with these other witnesses, it's pretty much a done deal. I don't see how they can, one, say UFOs don't exist, or two, come out and say that they're not some kind of a threat to national security.
Yeah, right now, the Air Force seems to be hunkering down. They're hoping this will all blow over next news cycle.
Yeah.
But like you said, it got so much press that I don't think this is going to go away in people's minds.
No.
And eventually, someone's going to, basically what's happened here is, by their silence, the Air Force is calling seven of us liars.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we've got our testimony and affidavits, signed affidavits. They're for public viewing. Anybody can go to my website and see them. And we're directly confronting the Air Force about their statement that no UFO incident reported or investigated by the Air Force has ever resulted in a national security
mm-hmm.
incident or event. And it's patently false. It's just an outright lie.
Oh, definitely. I know there's a couple of UK radio shows. I know you didn't want to mention the name, and I've been on them, and they were just brutal. And they didn't care about the facts or the evidence or anything else. They were just a total hatchet job and a disinformation campaign. So I imagine, I'm pretty sure I know who you're talking about as far as whoever did the interview with you over there.
Yeah. Well, I look at it this way. If they're talking about it, that's a plus. Even if they're trying to, negate it somehow. But like I said, my evidence is out there for anybody to look at. I'm completely open about showing the original documents to anybody that's
mm-hmm.
bona fide investigator or anything like that. And, of course, I'd be willing to swear on my oath in Congress, so-called.
Yeah. Yeah, we have the evidence we have here is just so overwhelming. And, and I told the guy, I said, look, we've got triple PhD Boeing engineers. Skunk Works operators, Lockheed engineers, all of them have witnessed the activity here, filmed it, will testify. And that wasn't enough, you know, because I didn't have a piece of a ship, you know, that wasn't enough. You know, I told them, I said, you know, I don't want a piece of the ship, because anybody who's ever come in contact with an alien artifact or a piece of a ship, it mysteriously disappears or they disappear. And so, it gets real ugly after that. So, I said, I really don't want a piece of the ship, and there's enough evidence there to choke a horse. So, you know, but they still, this guy still just, that was the only thing he could try to discredit me with, and he focused everything around that. And then finally I just told him, I said, you know, you have paranormal in front of your station. And I said, this is not paranormal. I said, this is about as normal as you can get. And I said, in fact, it's probably one of the most closed-minded, you know. And they actually hung up on me, so, and did some shotgun effect, you know, and then hung up on me. It was amazing. I couldn't believe it. I just said, what was that about, you know? So, but you know, I just, well, the evidence is here, you know, the air traffic controllers, the pilots, you know, all the evidence that we have here is here if anybody wants to see it. The footage, you know, cameras don't have an imagination with the testimony of the witnesses. But, you know, it's still, I know there are some people out there, and I'm sure you're going to run into them, and they have an agenda, and that agenda is disinformation.
Right.
And exactly. And they're going to do everything they can to discredit, you know, attack your character on every level.
See, what they're basing their disinformation campaign on is human nature is that, you know, we think we know what our world is like and what is true and what isn't true. We've kind of conjured these things in our minds, and that's what they play on. They play mm-hmm. on people's current status quo beliefs, this is a real phenomenon, and by that I mean it's I don't think anybody can really explain it mm-hmm. at this point. I mean, I know you've had a lot of experiences out there. By the way, we can talk about what I saw when I was out there too.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to hear, you know, tell listeners what your experience was while you were here, even though it was a slow night, you know, because of the weather and the clouds and everything, but we did have a little activity.
Well, it didn't seem slow to me. I was pretty excited about it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, well, of course, we went out there me and my wife visited you this last summer. I can't remember when it was, September 2nd, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out to that big field you've got out there at about 10 o'clock at night. You came out with your binoculars, that night vision binoculars.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, we began to see lights on Mount Adams. And you were gracious enough to let me use the binoculars most of the evening. And I was looking at these lights, and they moved very slowly. This one particular light moved very slowly, and it seemed to be on the mountain or very close to the mountain. And every once in a while, it would flare. The light would flare. And you pointed out to me that there are no roads on Mount Adams. From our vantage point, we couldn't see any roads. And there was a large snowfield on the right side where this light was. So it couldn't have been an automobile. And I don't know what a helicopter would be doing out there in the middle of the night around a big snowfield. And besides, I don't think this was a helicopter
mm-hmm.
from what I could see. And so we watched that. I'm sure we watched that for a good 30 to 40 minutes. And the light would just kind of move slowly around that mountain area, around that snowfield.
Mm-hmm.
And well, the next morning I got up and I took a closer look at Mount Adams, and you could see it clearly from your place. What is it, about 13, 14 miles away?
Yeah, about 13 miles away.
Yeah. And you could see it clearly. It was a beautiful day. I could see it clearly. I could clearly see that there were no roads there. In the area we were looking at, and it was just a big snowfield.
have a, in that area up there, if you go up there, it's on the reservation, basically, and there's it's in wilderness area, and there's no vehicles at all are allowed up in that area. So that's one thing. There are no vehicles allowed in the area. The other thing is, like we said, there are no roads in that area, and the terrain there, you can't transverse that terrain. It's giant lava boulders with the snow field in between, and there are more lava boulders, and there's no way of getting around up there. There's one area on the far right side of the mountain, as far as you can see to the right side of the mountain, there's a trail up there where sometimes hikers go up that trail, and they have little headlamps on, but nothing...
No headlamp.
No, the luminosity and the candle power would take...
Right.
To see this 13 miles away is just beyond imagination. And also, too, a helicopter, you would hear it. I mean, when there's a helicopter flying around that mountain, it is so loud. And we've seen them rescue people before.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, with their spotlights on and everything else. And it's nothing like we would see. And you see the running lights and everything else on them. So, you know, these lights are one solid light. And I believe you said it had a green color to it, or a kind of a greenish tint to it.
Yeah, at one point I thought it did look greenish, yes.
Uh-huh.
So it might have been a slow night for you, but that stuck with me. That was very interesting.
Yeah. You have to come and spend two or three nights here, and then it gets real crazy, especially when they power up. They fly right over the group, and they light the whole field up, and they pulse you, and you feel it. You feel the energy coming from these ships when they do this, and everybody gets real high and giddy, and, you know, nobody gets scared or runs. Everybody's cheering and having a good time, and I see this over and over with literally, you know, we've been here for 25 years, and the activity for the past 15 has just been intense.
Mm-hmm.
So I have seen, like, thousands of people come up here and see these ships and experience them, and have a great time and excited and everything. And I don't see this fear that they say is going to happen if somebody says these ships exist, because the people that I've seen are so excited. I mean, they are cheering and screaming and shooting lasers up at them and telling them to come down, you know.
I think this issue about fear over disclosure is way overblown. Of course, it plays right into the government's hands as a reason for not disclosing. But I think the majority of people by now realize that there's got to be life outside this planet. I mean, we found water on Mars. We found water on the Moon, for gosh sakes, you know. And so it's not much of a reach to think that if there's life elsewhere, that life could have been more advanced than us. What we've had, only had technology for a few hundred years. I mean, advanced technology, I don't think people would panic. At least not the majority of people. There'll always be some that would panic, but you have that in any situation.
Yeah, I've got some. I just had a long conversation and did some interviews with Jeff Peckman and I'm forgetting his first name. Dolan.
Richard Dolan.
Is it Richard? Yeah, Richard Dolan. And you know, and we kind of got into it. And he said it. All the evidence that he's looking at, clearly points to a secret space fleet and places on Mars and. Well, he said the Moon for sure, Mars possibly, you know. But
you're talking about
a U.S.
space fleet.
Yeah, a U.S. space fleet that has been playing with some back engineered technology for some time. But I think about that whole process there. That what you saw, I don't believe it was had anything to do with our stuff. I think it was definitely something from another world. And the things that we see up here, too, as well, show just a command of physics that is just mind-boggling. When you see some, like right in that same area where you saw that ship, we have on film one of those ships morphing from one to three and then back to one again and doing it for about 45 minutes.
Wow.
with multiple witnesses, you know, to back it up. So, you know, when you see something do something like that, you're going, wait a minute, this is some either extreme holographic nanotechnology or something. I don't know what it is, but...
Can I ask you a question, James?
Sure.
Well, why do you think you're having so much activity around your ranch?
I think there's two reasons. One, you know, it's one of those chicken or the egg, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Yeah.
You know, this is kind of out there for some people, but one, I know that I'm connected to this, what's happening there, and I didn't at first. I had no idea, but later on I found out. And we've been focusing for 25 years doing very intense process-oriented therapy, cleaning up our consciousness, getting rid of the fear and the old wounds and traumas, and practicing, you know, deep meditation and other Tibetan techniques for self-mastery. And so I think we've risen to the occasion. That's one thing. The other thing is this land here is a vortex. It's like a really high-energy place. And I was actually guided here on an inner level to come here and to set this up. And I thought I was setting up a retreat center for self-mastery and healing, or the awakening healing process, and turned out they were part of that later, I found out. And now the other thing is that this place also has a very ancient history of UFOs. And it goes back to the Native Americans who said, they were their teachers and healers, and they taught them many things, and they took their wounded and their sick up to this place up there on the mountain, right where you saw that light, actually. And they used to go inside, and they'd bring them back out, you know, a day later. They had a broken leg or something. They'd come back out a day later, and it'd be mended. And
wow.
And that's their lore, you might say, or legends, which I don't think are legends. And then you have the fire tower spotters and the Forest Service people and all those people talking about it. Kenneth Arnold lost sight of the ships when they descended on the western slopes of Mount Adams back in 1947. So Dr. J. Allen Hynek, David Akers, Greg Long, Bill Vogel, all these old UFO investigators have come up to this area and have seen the ships and know that it's an ongoing thing. So there's a long, long history of activity in this area. It's an internationally known UFO hotspot now, and much to the chagrin of those who would not like this information to get out. And I've had quite an exciting life since I've been doing this, with people would like to not see me talk anymore.
Well, maybe you ought to be the UN ambassador that would say hello to the aliens when they first land.
Yeah, we've kind of already done that. So.
You've already done that.
You know, they're 15 years late on that one, but you won't hear about it in the mainstream, that's for sure. And there's reasons why, but, you know, we'll let people figure those ones out for themselves. But anyway, that's the history of this place. I mean, it just has a long, long history, and you know, you can't really wrap your head around this unless you get into the higher dimensional aspects of it. Like Michio Kaku said, you know, he said SETI and all these other groups are looking in the wrong place. And actually, anything that comes through SETI is has to go through NSA before they can release it. So you're not going to hear anything from SETI.
Yeah.
And you know, I look at the panel that they have of this big meeting they're having. I think it's the Royal Science. I guess it's like the Royal Science Academy. They have all the big who's who, and they're going to have a big thing about extraterrestrials now, and have a big meeting about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Stephen Hawking is on there, and these other people. And I hate to say it, as brilliant as these people are, they do not have a clue as to what's going on, or they've been compromised, one or the other.
It's real interesting that Dr. Michio Kaku is opening up to this whole idea of extraterrestrial visitation. I'm going to be a guest on his show next week, as a matter of fact.
Awesome, yeah. I want to get on his show or have him on my show. I've been trying to get him on my show, and we've exchanged some really good emails about, you know, Planck energy and how much Planck energy it would take to move into the other dimensions, and I was countering with some other things, and we were going back and forth, and he said, you know, this is really getting interesting. I'm going to put these questions to my students and see what they can come up with. And I haven't heard back from him, but, you know, I took it more into the quantum physics area. Yeah. And
well, you know, he was in supported Leslie Keene's new book. He thought it was very well written, and that we ought to be taking this thing more seriously.
Yeah, and definitely.
He said the same thing about our statements too. He said this, about the testimony we gave, that it ought to be looked into more seriously.
You know, I think I have a feeling about Michio, and I can kind of read people pretty well, and I think he knows a lot more than he can talk about, and has probably experienced a lot more than he can talk about, but he still probably has to, you know, play the line a little bit, being in the position he's in, and you know, let it out a little at a time. But I just have a feeling that he's very connected on many other levels, and probably knows a lot more than he can talk about.
You may be right.
You know, I think a lot of these people there know so much more. What I find amazing is that the just a couple of weeks ago, I was, you know, at this other retreat center, and this woman comes up, and we saw this woman, and it was for a totally non-related event. And this friend of mine and I were looking at this woman. She shows up, and she's probably the most, you know, seemed very, very conservative, not doesn't want to have anything to do with any of this stuff or anything. And that's the way she looked at first glance. And so I turned around, I just started talking to her about it, and there were several other people there, and all of a sudden she just like opened up, and it just blew my friend away when he saw this. And he goes, I can't believe it. He goes, I would have never imagined that this woman would have known anything about this. And she'd had all these other experiences. She was part of I don't really want to get her in trouble because she is, you know, did a lot of work for certain agencies and things like that. And she says, oh, they're fully aware of it. And we've had our own encounters. And she goes, I've had my own personal experiences, and her father had, and he's in a real sensitive area. And just out of the blue, she just comes out with all this stuff. And then other people were piping in, you know, I've seen them too. And pretty soon everybody was saying, yeah, I totally believe in it. And it's just nobody's talking about it.
Right.
You know, they're afraid to break the ice or look funny. You know, there's fear of self-acceptance or something, or approval, but...
Yeah, really, that's ridiculous, and that's why we're pushing so hard for disclosure, because we all should be talking about it openly,
mm-hmm.
and without giggling about it. And,
yeah.
This is a serious subject. I mean, we're talking about, you know, visitations from another world.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to deal with them, or whoever they are? Are we going to treat them the same way we did the Native Americans when we first came to this country, or the blacks? You know, how are we going to treat visitors from another world? We all ought to be in that discussion. You know?
Yeah, I would love to be in that discussion, but... I don't know. I've kind of shied away from some of those disclosure projects. We've had Alfred Weber's been up here. Have you been on his show? Or I'm sure you probably have.
No.
Oh, you have to get on his show. He's great. But he's been up here, and you know, Michael Sala has been up here too. And so those two guys have been here. They've seen the ships, and they know this is the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
They're fully supportive of us. You know, the people that actually taken the time to come here and have their own experience know what's going on. But, you know, we still have those armchair investigators that throw stones from afar. That just comes with the territory. And I'm sure you've had a few stones thrown your way
by these
very same people.
Right.
But, you know, if you weren't there, you can't really make any kind of intelligent comment about it if it wasn't your experience and you weren't there.
Right.
You know,
it just becomes another story, you know, another tale.
Yeah.
That's the way some people look at it.
Now, one of the things that people, I'm getting just tons of email about it, and people are very afraid of one thing, and Carol Rosen talks a lot about that, and that creating more fear and aggression towards off-worlders and creating this as a threat and moving this in a very threatening manner.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking about, you know, Wernher von Braun's statements about one of the the last false flag programs they're going to run is a mock ET invasion or a fake invasion and Project Blue Beam and all these other things. But, you know, she talks a lot about that. Do you have any ideas on that? Or if you don't want to comment on it, that's fine as well.
I'll give you my position on what I think. And this is just speculation. I don't think, for the most part, that these alien visitors are trying to be aggressive or trying to dominate us or our world. I've got to believe, and I've gone through this with my wife. This is kind of my philosophy. I've got to believe that a very advanced civilization would have gone through what we're going through now. And that is fighting in wars amongst each other and developing nuclear weapons,
mm-hmm.
and getting past that stage without annihilating themselves, you know, getting past the stage of this kind of technology where we're building more fearsome weapons that can completely annihilate us. If we can get past this, we will be on a good path towards a better state of consciousness worldwide, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's what these extraterrestrials, if they are so far advanced from us, and I think they are, have probably gotten past this stage. And so they understand how to get along with
mm-hmm.
each other. And that's where we have to go. We have to learn how to work together as a world community and not as just a group of nations that's ready to blow each other to bits.
We've had some discussions about this because I know, we have back engineered these things due to Roswell and went to Bell Labs, and Corso blew a lot of this out of the water there, brought it all out. And, you know, we have I've talked to some very, you know, people with several PhDs under their belt that work for these black projects, and they've made it very clear. We have anti-gravity, counter-gravity, fuel-less energy technology, healing technologies beyond your wildest dreams. But these seem to be held back, you know, from the populace. And you could imagine if we just got our act together and chose to live in harmony with each other and the planet and then brought these technologies in,
yeah.
where we could advance to, what kind
yeah.
of a civilization we could create from
yeah.
that.
But you know why they're holding that technology is for military applications, and that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
The military is at the core of holding the secrecy about this phenomenon. And the reason
mm-hmm.
is because they don't want anyone else to know how, you know, important our technology is with regard to warfare. And that's wrong. That's just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We've got too many black projects going. We're spending trillions on these black projects with no oversight. I've talked, believe me, I went to the Air Force Academy, and some of my classmates have been involved with these black projects. And more than once they've told me that it's very easy to get by congressional oversight. You know,
mm-hmm.
The managers of these black projects have to report to Congress every so often about, you know, where the money's going. But it's only to a few people in Congress, not the entire Congress. It's just the people on these committees, you know, these
mm-hmm.
Armed Services Committees. And it's so easy to pull the wool over their eyes. So basically, we've got no oversight over these black projects, trillions of dollars, and the military is all about fighting wars. That's all they're about. They're about building things to kill people, to fight wars, and somehow we've got to change that kind of concept so that we're more about finding ways to work together, and like you say, we need to know what they know about the extraterrestrial presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of sad because I see that, you know, if we treat this with the standard military mindset, you know, everything's a threat that we can't dominate or control that's coming into our skies, and we're going to put our best technologies up there to greet them, you know, with aggression, unfortunately.
Right.
And that's not a very advanced approach to this, and like you're saying, I think we need some kind of oversight. I was talking to Richard Dolan about that, and I said, you know what we need? We need a truth and reconciliation panel, or a truth and forgiveness panel, where everybody is let off the hook, saying, okay, from this point on, we're going to shift the energy, and then we need a panel that can implement this, that can get this out into the private sector, that will oversee this whole thing, and then make sure these people are of high integrity, and that's about the only way we're ever going to turn this planet around is to have some kind of a
right.
You know, a truth and forgiveness panel, and then shift it after that into a how do we use this in the highest and best good of humanity and the earth, and still maintain security at the same time.
No, I agree, and that's a good objective. But first, the government has to admit that this is a real phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
And that they have been tracking this phenomenon as long as they, you know, it's been obvious to them, probably back World War II or even before.
Oh, yeah. I have a German friend of mine that is a physicist, and he was talking about how that they were back engineering things way back, you know, before the war, and they had their ships and their technologies, and he said, this is old news. I mean, this is really old news, and they're just
right.
Completely surprised it hasn't come out into the private sector.
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of this, but I've heard that I think in 1932 there was a crashed saucer in Italy, and Mussolini, I think, was in power at the time, and recovered this crashed saucer, and that's how the Nazis started getting the technology from this. Had you heard that?
I have, yeah. Yeah, I've heard some other ones, too, not just one, but they actually had occupants, and they
mm-hmm.
they weren't the Greys, they were humans. They were extremely advanced humans that had some kind of a problem with one of their ships. I don't know what happened, and they went down, and they actually gleaned the technology from it and had them on hand for quite a while.
Right.
You know, so that was kind of interesting. But, you know, unfortunately, we're running up to the end of the hour, but before we sign off, there's two things. I want to thank you so much for your, you know, integrity and courage in bringing this information out, and also give your website. What's the best way that people can get a hold of your book?
Beta Giant, they can go to Amazon.com and order it through them.
Okay.
That's probably the best way.
And as far as reading up on your evidence, your best evidence, and which website should they go to for that?
Well, right now, the best place to read up on my evidence, and also, we didn't get a chance to talk about the Air Force cover-up collusion with the Conan Committee, but I've written
mm-hmm.
two papers, which I'm kind of proud of, I guess. One is that my evidence, which is on theufochronicles.com. These are both on there. And then the other one is called Back to Montana, I think I called it that, or Visiting Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And that talks about the Air Force cover-up of my case and the Echo case, and how they colluded with the Conan Committee to keep it secret. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it never got into the final report, the Conan Committee report.
Yeah.
So
pretty much
yeah. By the way, if I have a second or two, I'd like to thank
sure.
everyone who contributed, donated. You know, we did this press conference on a shoestring, and it was a grassroots effort. We don't belong to any organization at all. It was just Hastings and I. Came up with this idea to get these people together, and so we got donations, and I'd like to thank all my Facebook friends especially, and people of Ojai, and Jose Escamilla, who donated the showing of his film a couple of times, and just so many people that really helped out. I'd like to thank them all.
Great. Well, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, and we'll probably have to do it again real soon.
Thank you, James. I appreciate it.
All right. Have a great evening.
Yeah, too. Good night.
All right. This is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio signing off. Have a great evening, and go out and watch the skies. That's where I'm going. And I'm sure I won't be disappointed. Anyway, have a great night.